Hello, Heather Stewart here. Before we start this week's show, I want to ask your opinion on something. Over the last couple of months, we've been covering some of what's happening in the political world across the Atlantic as the US gears up for a presidential election in November. So what would you like to hear more or less of? Are there questions you'd like answered that you can't find anywhere else? We've already had a great response from listeners, but we'd appreciate hearing your thoughts on our coverage. So please send any insights you might have to podcasts@theguardian.com. Now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
The Tories head into battle against coronavirus, bullying allegations, and trade negotiators from the US and the EU27. I'm Heather Stewart, and this is Politics Weekly.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming along. I'm very glad to be joined this morning by the government's Chief Medical Officer and Chief Scientific Advisor. Today we've published the Coronavirus Action Plan.
As the number of confirmed cases of coronavirus, or COVID-19, continues to increase across the globe, the UK government on Tuesday launched a 28-page action plan setting out how it will deal with a possible epidemic. We'll ask whether we should feel reassured or alarmed by the government's approach, and whether Boris Johnson could have done more sooner to show that he was on top of the crisis.
It has been alleged that I have briefed the media against the Home Secretary. This, along with many other claims, is completely false.
Coronavirus won't be the only battle on the government's plate, as we saw from the explosive resignation of Sir Philip Rutnam, the Home Office's most senior civil servant, over bullying allegations, which is still sending shockwaves through Westminster. Rutnam plans to sue the government for unfair dismissal, accusing the Home Secretary Priti Patel of being involved in a, quote, vicious and orchestrated briefing campaign against him, and calling her a liar. Michael Gove, the Cabinet Office Minister, gave her his staunch support, but announced a Cabinet Office investigation. The Home Secretary wholeheartedly denies all accusations, even if the tally of people accusing her is rising. Boris Johnson has been criticised by Labour for his decision not to go to badly flooded areas in the north of England, despite making time for such trips during the election. Coupled with impromptu trips away, some have begun calling him a part-time Prime Minister. So is he simply self-isolating for fear of getting things wrong, or is this all part of a master plan? Johnson can't really shy away from trade talks, however, as negotiations with both the US and the EU27 kick off this week. On top of all that, we'll look at the latest in the Labour leadership campaign and the results from Super Tuesday in America. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, as the number of people in the UK confirmed to have coronavirus hit 51 yesterday, Johnson sought to reassure the public that he and his cabinet have got everything covered. He personally launched the government's coronavirus action plan, which, as he pointed out, was meant to cover all eventualities. One of the measures highlighted is the need for increased publicity to better inform the public on good hygiene practices and how employees should deal with illness. It's probably best then that the government decided to end its boycott of the country's national broadcaster and have the Health Secretary Matt Hancock appear on the Today programme. Joining me in the studio to discuss the government's response to COVID-19 and much more is The Guardian's Polly Toynbee, Conservative home writer and Johnson biographer Andrew Jimpson, and the comedian and host of the political party podcast Matt Ford. Andrew, it was noticeable, I thought, that Boris Johnson decided to put himself front and centre yesterday. We haven't had many down, I don't think we've had any Downing Street press conferences, but there he was yesterday, flanked by the Chief Medical Officer, the Chief Scientific Officer, giving his plan. Did he know this was, he needed to get out in front of this publicly?
Yes, he did. And he knew that you can only deal with something as serious as this as a team. In fact, you can only do anything in government by getting everyone working. And so he had those two very senior people there with him. And although Boris finds it very difficult to strike a serious tone, I thought the whole effort was quite serious yesterday.
Matt, it also includes potentially quite sweeping powers, doesn't it, for what could be quite sort of life-changing decisions for us. We could all have quite a boring summer, it seems, doesn't it? We're all going to be socially distancing. We're all going to be sitting at home, I fear.
That's right. I mean, some of the powers are quite draconian in terms of the ability to isolate people. Some of them actually, having read it, I mean, crucially as a citizen, I think you just want reassurance at a time like this. And I think the story can move on quite quick. So there was a frustration that perhaps Boris Johnson hadn't been visible. The moment he stood there with two experts, particularly from a flank of politics that apparently doesn't like them, was a kind of big move. And just as a public, you said, it just, it's the language of control is quite reassuring. And reading quite practical, pragmatic measures that, as a citizen, whether you're left or right, I think are at the very least reassuring. And at a time like this, that's all most people want.
Polly, these are the kinds of things that really test a leader, aren't they? That you don't expect. I remember doing a Guardian Live event at the start of the year about what was coming next in politics, and we talked about all kinds of things. And some very shrewd Guardian reader put their hand up and said, you know, what's the sort of black swan event? What's the unexpected thing that'll blow everything off course? Because there always is one. And you know, this is going to use up an awful lot of time and energy. And there are some really difficult judgments to be made, aren't there?
There are, and I don't think Boris Johnson looks the part at all. He looks extremely uneasy trying to be serious. I mean, he's there to be the cheer everybody up, morning in Great Britain person. He's not really there for this kind of thing. Prime ministers can do very well out of crises of this sort. After all, nobody's going to blame him for the existence of this virus. But and you remember in the beginning, Gordon Brown did very well out of the foot and mouth crisis, which he dealt with well in his early days. Like Boris, it was in his honeymoon phase. I don't think this is going to suit Boris very well. If I was him, I would stand well back and every single day put out those medical officers, the chief scientific officer, have them do the official line every day. Boris telling you to wash your hands just doesn't make sense. I think what you need to say is you need to say, look, I'm not the expert. Here are the experts. We will obey what they say. Listen to them. Listen to nobody else. Listen to no nonsense on the internet. Don't even listen to nonsense from politicians. These are the guys who know. And I think he'd get most cred by doing that.
That was sort of the approach he was trying to take yesterday, Andrew, wasn't it? Although he was there, but he did defer. He seemed a bit like a sort of chair of that meeting. He deferred quite a lot.
That was what he was trying to do. He's also been trying for years to persuade people, not always at all successfully, that he actually believes in the NHS, but palpably dealing with something like this, you really do need a national, well, you need, of course, a global system, but you need, within the nation, you need a national system, which they don't properly have, for example, in the United States. So I think actually a lot of people, if it continues as it did yesterday, will feel proud of the NHS, because actually there are all these people who understand about epidemics and all sorts of things to do with this virus, and we've got them, and they're being deployed, and they know what needs to be done.
Oh, don't count on it. The NHS is absolutely on a knife edge before this came along. I mean, there was no spare capacity of any kind. Brilliant piece in The Guardian yesterday by an ICU doctor saying their intensive care unit absolutely can't cope with a whole lot of really, really severe respiratory cases. And then at the point at which it bounces back on the government again, well, why did you let the NHS get so threadbare?
I've always found it disconcerting that hospitals don't contain empty beds. They should have lots of empty beds for when people are really ill. And I agree that's a bad thing, but I'm afraid it's been a bad thing for quite a long time.
Well, the last decade, it's got steadily worse. Yeah. We're now at over 95%, I think.
Yeah.
Matt, they'll have to spend more, won't they?
Well, yeah, in the short term, yeah. But this is, you know, Boris Johnson's already shown in the election campaign and his departure effectively from the sort of austerity that we've seen over the last 10 years that he's prepared to triangulate, and he's prepared to at least promise money. Delivering it may be different, but at a time like this, I think he can absolutely afford to spend.
And it's a big test of whether he can do it fast.
Yeah, I think the danger with, if he was to sort of take Polly's very sound advice, is that I think as a politician, you do always need to be, not necessarily the face of it, but you need to be visible, particularly if you're a leader. And the presumption that if you just hand it over to the officials, that does deal with that problem. It creates another problem in that the public do want a more human face. And experts and civil servants can only be human to an extent because they're bound by their professionalism. They need a political voice there. And you saw the headway that Nicola Sturgeon made when she was actually the sort of first political leader we'd seen. And I think perhaps Boris was partly reactive to that. If I was Boris Johnson, I would try and be a bit more visible in this period and look to reassure. And I always think with politicians, do the stuff that you're not known for. And he is known as the sunshine guy and all the rest of it and all the positivity. But if he can show the country that actually he can handle the serious stuff, then he's in a far stronger position. Whether he can or not is a different question.
Well, and he doesn't have much choice, does he?
No.
At this point, and it was also interesting, Andrew. I mean, it's a sort of navel gazing media point, but there was Matt Hancock on the Today programme, which the government has eschewed for some months. You need to get your message across via whatever medium you can in a situation like this, don't you? Whatever your ideological qualms about particular message carriers.
Yeah, Hancock absolutely had to be on the Today programme. I think they've made their point that they're not going to let the Daily Mail sort of tell them what to do hour by hour in order to provide a continual stream of stories for Mail Online. I think that's quite sensible, actually, particularly when there isn't a general election. I don't blame him for doing less, fewer visits when there isn't an election on. But they made that point, and of course you have to use the Today programme as well as lots of other ways of reaching the widest possible public.
Polly, if we weren't trying to tackle this very serious crisis and all talking about it, we would be aghast, wouldn't we, at these extraordinary bullying allegations against the Home Secretary. That statement from Philip Ruttenham at the weekend, the Home Office Permanent Secretary, was quite something, wasn't it? Permanent Secretaries don't usually go on the telly
absolutely unprecedented. I mean, occasionally someone like, say, Ivan Rogers, after they've left office, will come back and say, you're getting it wrong about Brexit, and he was the great expert on that. But to have somebody who resigns, who refused because he refuses to sign a non-disclosure agreement, because he says, I want to protect the other staff who work with her, and I need to come out, I won't accept the deal. They offered him plenty of money to go away quietly, he'd already got his K, but he wouldn't do it. And I don't think that's ever happened before. And to go out and speak to the BBC, the government's loathed BBC, and tell what's happened. I mean, some pretty brutal stories of really outrageous swearing, bad behaviour, bullying. But you do suspect it comes from the top, the culture. It's not just Priti Patel. The culture comes from everything we know about what Dominic Cummings says to the people under him. It spreads all the way through the system.
Andrew, is this a culture that Boris would like or encourage, or is this something else going on here?
I don't think so. I haven't seen him bully people. I mean, he can be amazingly selfish, but I don't think he's a bully, personally. I think Priti Patel is a very determined character indeed, and feels that that's how to deal with life. I mean, I interviewed her some years ago, and she said that her parents had got up at 4:30 every morning for 40 years to run their newsagent's business. That was a very, very tough 40 years, I think, in her opinion, building back what they had had earlier on when they lived in Uganda. So I think she's a tough cookie and very, very tough to work for.
Why does Boris hire bullies to do it for him? So he's got Cummings to be Mr. Nasty and he can be Mr. Smiley. He's got Dominic Raab and Priti Patel, both of those.
The benevolent landlord who has a factor who is really
the sleeping
tough
partner
on the tenants.
Goes around with a baseball bat.
I'm sorry.
Matt, they seem to want to hold on to her, don't they, for the moment at least. Michael Gove was very defensive of her, said she was an excellent Home Secretary.
I think there's a wider context to this. I think social attitudes are hugely changing on workplace culture. I worked in politics for a bit, and this is not just the sole preserve of the Tory party. I saw bullies in the Labour Party. They were always the most inadequate people. They were always people who I thought were the least talented people. And they're ineffective as bosses. It doesn't work to bully people. It reduces productivity. And I think 10, 15 years ago, this would have been fine. Well, not fine, but tolerated. I think things are changing. And I think, not that there'll necessarily be a Me Too movement or a Time's Up thing, but I think there will be a wider culture where it's not just about politics. It will be about entertainment. It will be about places like this and ordinary people's working lives where people say, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. And I think behaviour like that, instead of being explained away by the way that her parents run her shop, will be seen for, if true, the despicable, inexcusable hell it makes other people's lives. And it will be taboo to defend that nonsense. And I hope that happens quickly.
Andrew, do you think if this Cabinet Office inquiry does find that these, at least some of these allegations have foundation, is Boris Johnson the sort of person who will be willing to chuck an ally over the side if that happens? Or is, I mean, it's quite a big test of a prime minister, I always think, who they are willing to let go and hang on to.
It's a very big judgment, isn't it? How long the story goes on for, how long you can... He'll be incredibly reluctant to do it. I mean, he might move her in a year or two's time to some role for which she might be better suited. But at the moment...
Hard to think what that might be, but...
Yes, but, you know,
bailiff.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
And also, it's not just about sacking Priti Patel, it's about the pressure that puts then on future controversies. And one of the things I thought David Cameron's really good at, as opposed to, say, Tony Blair, was holding on to ministers. There were numerous times he could have sacked Jeremy Hunt and didn't, because it then sends the message, actually, we're not going to always sack people at the first sign of trouble. So it's not just about Priti Patel, it's about then that domino effect of the next minister that's accused of something, and after that, and then you get in the habit where you're just sacking people all the time, and in the end you lose some talented people. Not that Priti Patel necessarily falls into that category, But that's the sort of wider danger of it.
The category she does fall into is absolute ideological purity. And we have, for the first time, probably the most ideologically pure cabinet of any party in my lifetime, where there is no disagreement. They brook no disagreement. Everything is yes, minister. They even had to chant his ministers. Humiliation, a most humiliated cabinet. He has fired everybody in the party who had even a slightly different view. I think it's remarkable and frightening. And when we look at who they are very ferocious lot. I mean, Dominic Raab, Priti Patel. I mean, Sajid Javid was a toughie. And well, we don't know about Rishi Sunak, but we shall find out soon enough at his budget.
Andrew, do you think that's right? This is a group of sort of ideological troops.
I'm not sure. Well, I think, oddly enough, I don't think the Prime Minister is really ideological. I think he's extremely eclectic. And many people would say, I mean, I wouldn't myself, but many people would say he's unprincipled. He wrote an article for staying in the European Union and one against, which, in my opinion, was intelligent, because I think there are actually arguments both ways. But nevertheless, he isn't terribly ideological. Priti Patel certainly follows whatever the party line is, which is not necessarily an ideological line, but it is a line. Yeah, she is on message.
She was one of the authors of Britannia Untrained, which at the time was a kind of outlier. That was not mainstream.
Right.
It was really far to the right. Yes. Kwasi Kwarteng, a whole lot of people writing pretty extreme stuff, you know, all this stuff about the British workers being the worst idlers in the world. They weren't mainstream then, but they've become mainstream now.
Yeah, Liz Truss, wasn't she one as well?
Yes, she was one too, absolutely. And she has extremely hard opinions about cutting the state right back. I've heard her make speech on that. You know, she would shred it to pieces. She thinks, austerity? What austerity?
But I don't think that's the party line, right?
I mean, I think they're going to spend a lot of money on, you know, infrastructure and all that sort of stuff. A Brexity Hezer, who the Prime Minister claims to be. The Hezer bit means spending a lot of money as well as having free ports and stuff. So it's a curious mixture.
High-vis Boris projects, but nothing for people who've got no money, they had all their benefits taken away or anything of that kind.
Well, he was asked the other day in the House of Commons at Prime Minister's Questions, I think by a Scottish nationalist, whether you could live on £111 a week, and he said no. He didn't evade it. He said no, that's impossible. So I think he does, whether he actually manages to live up to the humane side of his character, I don't know. But I think he does recognise that grinding the faces of the poor is horrible and, he would say, unconservative thing to do.
I do hope you're right, but next week we shall find out.
And as if tackling coronavirus and bullying allegations wasn't enough, negotiations with both the EU and the US over future trade deals kicked off this week. We'll talk more about that after the break. And Paul Owen will tell us what happened in the US on Super Tuesday. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, on the same day the government's emergency committee, COBRA, was being scrambled to deal with coronavirus, Liz Truss's Department for International Trade published a document which was seen as the start to post-Brexit trade talks with the US. A couple of pieces of information stood out. One, the UK government insisted it would not water down animal welfare standards or put the NHS up for sale to secure a trade deal with Trump. And the document revealed the tiny likely impact on the economy of even the best-case US-UK trade deal. Matt, it's one thing to get Brexit done, isn't it? And I think the government would quite like it if we just sort of stopped talking about it now and moved on. But it's quite a big test, isn't it, coming up in the next few months?
Well, the reality, you know, this was one of the things that people, that I think seeped through, even to people that were perhaps wavering in that referendum, was this idea that our relationship with the EU seemed quite restrictive. And why couldn't we trade with the rest of the world? That wasn't an unreasonable conversation to have. When that hypothesis meets reality, and you're talking about 0.1% growth over 18 years.
Mm. Yeah,
I mean, it's statistically negligible. It's almost pointless to even do the deal, it seems. As a Remainer and someone who accepts the result and accepts the election and all that, you do think, oh man, you know, we warning people that this was going to be nonsense, and it's turned out to be nonsense. And maybe it doesn't matter. You know, Boris is a salesman, and this is happening during a honeymoon period. So, you know, we can do a deal. I'm not only with the United States, and we can do a deal with Australia, by the way, and with everyone else. I think there's going to be a great deal. And it may well prove between me. Wrong. And I think we are. We do great deals with many countries. And they can, you know, look, this isn't just about trade. This is about building bridges with our closest ally. And there will be some way that he can.
I was going to ask Andrew whether it's really about the numbers and what Boris will say, but I think we probably know what he'll say. It's not really about the numbers in a sense. It's not really about the economics.
Well, the numbers are always wrong. The forecast. I mean, no one, all intelligent forecasters admit as much, but...
wrong by a factor of 10 or 100?
Yes, often, yes. 1,000. But the conventional wisdom is that if you've won an election, you should do the tough, unpopular things early on. Yeah. And it doesn't appear they're going to do that as far as taxes are concerned. But who knows? We'll know in the budget. Conventionally, you put taxes up, but I don't think they're going to do that. But if they're going to have a bust-up with the European Union, then the sooner the better, really. People are going to be absolutely horrified if there actually is trouble at Dover or whatever. And you've got to get it sorted out. And you can't let the European Union play for time and have the crisis sort of 3 months before the next general election. You've got to have the crisis soon. And Johnson, if you face him with the choice of options, although he has a well-hidden streak of prudence and caution, if you give him two options, he will usually choose the riskier one, or what seems on the face of it like the riskier one. He'll think that's actually safer, and he'll precipitate a bust-up with Brussels in the near future, I would guess.
Thinking that it will be rocky, but it will be long over before.
Well, you've got to show them that you're serious, and you've got to confirm to the people who voted for you that you're serious about it as well.
Polly, there's some quite interesting issues to be tackled, aren't there, in the sort of what kind of trading relationship we have and what kind of Britain we are. So one of the reasons The Economist was saying that the upside from the UK-US deal is so small is actually that the Tories have allowed themselves to be tied to animal welfare standards and other things and have been quite cautious. Some of the real free traders would love us to get rid of all those things and not worry about any of that stuff. And, you know, you could probably have a bigger economic upside if you were willing to put the NHS on the table potentially and so on. But it's in some ways, it's quite a cautious approach, isn't it?
They've set it up to a point, but it's interesting to see how many kites are being flown saying, listen, there's nothing really wrong with chlorinated chicken. The Americans aren't dying like flies for eating it. I mean, the fact that it's not actually about the chlorine, it's about the treatment of the chickens that require the chlorine. There's been, you can see them log rolling, a pitch rolling in the Tory press, really trying to say these things are not too bad. Hormones? What's wrong with hormones? We've all got hormones.
Well, Johnson's thing is it has to be governed by science and not mumbo jumbo, isn't it? That's his sort of...
Yes, and after all, the Americans have scientists as well, and if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for... I think it's possible that they will try and make that leeway, because I don't think you can make a deal with the Americans if you are absolutely not touching agriculture. That's what they've said. I mean, maybe Trump will back down, but he's not a backer down, really. Why would he care?
And that's another clash coming, isn't it, about how much you protect farmers over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years? Because, again, there are free traders in the Tory party who would say, why have we got any farm subsidies at all? Now we've got rid of the CAP, let's just stop subsidising these guys. And if some of them go bust, shrug, you know.
We had one of the key advisors, a very clever man called Dr. Tim Lunick, who is saying, why do we worry about farmers? It's a minuscule part of, you know, why do we worry about fishermen? It's tiny part of our economy.
Which is true in economic terms.
But he's the same person who said, why do we worry about the north? I mean, nobody's going to go and work up there, make them all come south. He's a big blue skies thinker, but possibly not a very good political one.
Yeah, and I think the question of why we should worry about the north has a very clear electoral answer for Boris Johnson now, doesn't it? I don't think any of those arguments will be getting much traction. Right, I'm pleased to be able to tell you there's only 1 month until the result of the Labour leadership contest is declared. Matt, how inspired have you been by this, what now seems like months of exciting contest?
I've been tickled by Richard Bergen. Not directly, but...
do you do a Bergen?
I made him wash his hands first.
Can you do a Bergen?
Well, I think Jeremy Corbyn should come back, by the way. And I think we should have a Tony Benn University. And I think we should have a Labour TV channel, because why not? And we should have a tabloid newspaper. And I think we should set up our own football team. And we should... I mean, it's constantly just chucking... It's obviously joking... And people are going, this is
that
a really
last, that last one will be announced within days,
oh,
I promise
man.
You.
I just find it, that clip of Andrew Marwick is, we can't go back to the future. I mean, there's so many. He's been a source of entertainment for a long time.
So Bergen, if you were to try and pick a winner based on who would be the... I mean, I feel like Keir Starmer's not going to be great for comedy. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, although people thought Ed Miliband wasn't going to be, and he ended up being quite... You know, a sort of great person to impersonate. So in the end, when they the spotlight reveals something of them. So at the moment, you might think, well, Keir Starmer seems quite straightforward and very professional. But in time, he was his any eccentricities he have may sort of come to the fore a little bit more than we'd think at the moment. But obviously, at the moment, he is just trying to reassure every wing of the party. Which is sometimes contradicting himself. But I think more than anything else, if there's one positive I take is, at least Labour is looking to be professional again. And the fact that was ever a threat and ever wasn't the case really is disgraceful. So at least Labour is starting to seem more adult.
Polly, whoever does take over on April 4th has quite a big challenge ahead of them, don't they? There's local elections coming up and it's quite difficult for Labour to sort of find its way into this conversation that's going on about Boris Johnson's government and what's it going to do and how's it going to handle these big issues?
Well, my view is that if Keir Starmer wins, suddenly the game looks quite different. I mean, Labour has been effectively counted out for the last decade. All of a sudden, you can imagine a Keir Starmer with a very, very solid and impressive and experienced shadow cabinet behind him. You know, there are a lot of people, you know, Rachel Reeves as his chancellor, but, you know, very serious economist. I mean, there's a whole list of them that I think would give this pretty feeble cabinet a real run for their money. I think it would frighten them. You know, we've got 4.5 years to the next election, but I think week after week, clever, serious people pounding away at the likes of Dominic Raab or, you know, Priti Patel. I think, I think Yvette Cooper would make mincemeat of Priti Patel. I think the game will change in a really interesting way. Long time till the next election. Who knows by then what the issues will be, but at least they're back in the game.
Andrew, do you think that's right? Do you think the Conservatives will have any concerns about this new regime coming up, whatever it turns out to be?
Well, it looks as though Starmer will win, and he is very good at building a case, and he's very good at seeing the flaw in what his opponent is saying. And also, I think one has the impression that he really detests people like Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg. He just doesn't think that people like that should be running the country. And so it will be a fascinating clash of very different and in many ways incompatible personalities. So Starmer is, you know, he's a human rights lawyer, and oddly enough, on his mother's side, Johnson has that legal background. His father, Sir James Fawcett, very distinguished international lawyer who, in the Court of Human Rights in Europe, put through all sorts of extremely liberal judgments.
I knew him. He would be turning in his grave at what Boris says and does. And Boris's utter ignoring of rules, laws, anything like that. I can't imagine what he would think.
Yes. Well, I don't know what he'd think either. I don't think Johnson would want his maternal grandfather to be turning in his grave. And I think that's some... If his maternal grandfather is turning in his grave, he'll want to stop him turning in his grave by showing that he's a less disgraceful person as far as the rule of law is concerned than obviously many people now suspect.
But it is interesting, isn't it, that... I mean, I presume what you were really trying to suggest was that he will have the measure of Starmer. He'll think, I know this type of person.
I don't know. Well, he's very clever, but he's, of course, doesn't have the command of detail always that he should. I mean, he's capable of it. He has a fantastically good memory. So he can remember the stuff if he's actually read it. But who knows? I don't think Theresa May was very good at the dispatch box. Well, she was sort of professional in a rather impregnable sort of way, but she wasn't very formidable, but neither was Jeremy Corbyn. So Prime Minister's questions, which is when... I mean, the media on one side, it's when the government today should be held to account, or the sort of high-profile half hour when they should be held to account. I think that will be very interesting to see how that goes between...
But Matt,
Starmer,
you will have observed Boris very carefully, plainly. Yes. You're listening with both ears finely tuned. I find it interesting that his language is pathetic. I thought he was going to be this great orator and speaker. He says fantastic every word, just like Donald Trump. It's going to be fantastic. It's fantastic. He has a very, very tiny vocabulary.
And he has a limited set of gags that he constantly reuses.
Stuff. Like Gordon Brown used
isn't,
to do that.
Isn't that what, isn't that what comedians do? That they
oh, of course. Yeah. No, I have a lot of respect for it.
They recycle the material and you refine it constantly. Yes. And then you find out what works and what doesn't.
Yes, but he obviously had a reputation as being this basically great work. Oh, I see. And that's kind of what was sold. And then when it reveals itself, you think, it's just basically saying the same thing.
He
every
does
time.
Drop in sort of Latinate and Greek words as well.
He will pick an absurd turn of phrase or a specific. So I bet with that trade deal, I think British consumers want to eat cherry cocoa pops. They sound quite nice. I don't have a problem. They sound quite delicious. And there'll be some sort of silly thing, and it makes for great pictures, and we all kind of get distracted by it because
shower trays. I've heard him say several times that there are restrictions on exporting British shower trays. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the value. Even if all of those restrictions were removed, I'm not sure what the value of that industry would be.
What's more, it's been debunked several times. It's not true.
You're right that he's very good at distracting people, and one should be careful of that because it leads some people to underestimate him. He does actually understand what the issue is. And when I wrote my biography of him, I read a great many of his older articles and. They usually open with an extended passage of autobiography and then some jokes and then some various stray remarks and then the point that he's making, which can be made in about 5 words, but it is basically quite a boring point. But there is, oddly enough, if you read his old articles, there almost always is a point heavily camouflaged.
So there's a method in this, metaphors.
He actually understands about power and he understands what the issues are and he calculates. I mean, of course, he does make mistakes. Everyone does. Quite capable of making mistakes, but we shouldn't think that he's not actually understanding what is at issue here and how. I mean, I think before the election, he stole so many Labour clothes. He just walked around stealing Labour stuff. That was very deliberate one could even use the word strategic. Well, you could call it either opportunist or strategic, but it was quite impressive.
Well, Labour were walking around, in a way, challenging the Tory government of 5 or 10 years ago. And this was, talking about anti-austerity and we can't have these terrible cuts. And actually Johnson was saying, no, you're absolutely right. Let's pour money into the NHS.
And it wasn't just that. It was he understood the culture of the country in a way that Labour didn't. And for the first time you saw a situation, well, not the first time, but what was really clear was he was really going after Labour votes and Labour were not talking to Tory voters at all. And I thought with those Johnson speeches, if you tore off the beginning and the end about Brexit, the middle chunk was a speech that Gordon Brown or Ed Miliband or Tony Blair could have made. And he was talking about life outside of London. These should be Labour themes and they haven't been. And I just thought his language, apart from Brexit, was centre ground, sounded liberal. But this is the great thing with Johnson and with a lot of Conservatives, they talk a really good game. They sound really great. The delivery is really what matters. And I do not trust him to deliver.
And meanwhile, we had the happy news at the weekend that he's expecting and going for third time lucky on the marriage front, Andrew. We do invite arrived yet.
He loves being married.
evidently.
Or getting married.
He only ever has about 10 days between marriages.
I've revelled in the moralising Tory press that usually goes on about the wickedness of divorcing men and single mothers and the whole, Ian Duncan Smith's entire social justice riff was all about, we're going to have a marriage bonus and all this. And they're all falling over themselves to say, sort of 4 pages of the Sunday Telegraph of Baby Joy and Dog Dylan and What a Happy Family. And you think, really, this is hypocrisy taken to a high degree.
But you have to, the thing is, and I have the same with the royal wedding, in that I'm not a monarchist in any way, but I would never want to begrudge other people's happiness. So I think it's quite hard, however people feel about Boris Johnson, to not wish them well and to not want them and to not kind of hope that maybe this will last and that it will be. Maybe two people in love have really found each other and... maybe I'm just being a soppy old
You'd have to be a bitter, pretty bitter kind of person, wouldn't you, not to wish someone happiness?
I mean, I know how former colleagues of mine will think is that the clever bugger's done this on purpose. And that was when I realised I had to stop working for the Labour Party, where everything...
He seems to have done it accidentally a few times in the past, I should probably say. But.
Yes, are we ever going to know which number child it is? He won't even say that.
No, that's right.
Well, he did write a very strong piece when Bill Clinton was having the whole dreadful Monica Lewinsky embarrassment, which was, I think, in many ways, just as acutely embarrassing as anything that's happened with the present president, but he wrote a strong piece defending Clinton in the Telegraph, saying that politicians have got to have a private life or life is hell. So that has been his, actually, on and off, it's been his
line. Oh, yes, he's been his no line, moralizer. That's been a line fair for, enough.
Yeah, and he has believed that he why the hell should he say how many children he's got? I mean,
On the happy baby news, I think we should probably end. But I can't do that without giving you all. This is like start the week. I can't end without giving you all an opportunity to plug your latest project. So Matt, you've got some dates coming up at which we can hopefully hear more of your Richard Bergen impression, which I'm very struck by.
Bergen and Trump and Boris and various others. I'm doing a tour called Brexit Pursued by a Bear, which is all around the country. You can get tickets through the website mattford.com/live, and I'm doing the South Bank Centre on the 10th and 27th of March.
Excellent. And my other two guests both have books out this week, I think. Andrew, is that right?
I'm going head-to-head with Polly Toynbee, which is always a
dangerous
mistake, actually. No, I've got a book out called Jimson's President's Brief Lives from Washington to Trump. It has pictures by Martin Rosen of The Guardian, and my friends tell me it's worth buying for the pictures alone.
how very modest.
And I will certainly go and catch up with your tour, and I will certainly read your president's book. My book, I'm afraid, is a bit less fun, but it's very important. It's called The Lost Decade, 2010 to 2020, written together with David Walker. And it's about all that we have lost in the last 10 years. It is about a lot of the things you don't see, the fraying of the fabric of civilization itself in lots of services, things that have just gone and won't be easy to get back in the next decade.
And we can read more about it in G2 today, I think, Polly, can't we?
Indeed, the double page spread on G2.
Thank you all very much. OK, now, before we finish up, yesterday the US was alive with the sound of Democratic nominees as 14 states went to the polls for what's called Super Tuesday. The former Vice President Joe Biden went into yesterday's vote confident after successfully winning in South Carolina last week. But the PAC also suffered a casualty as Pete Buttigieg, the winner of the first primary in New Hampshire, announced he was dropping out. So who were the big winners and losers of the last 24 hours? And what does this result tell us about who will eventually go up against Donald Trump in the November presidential election? The Guardian's Paul Owen explains more in this report.
We're in the middle of the race to decide which Democrat will face Donald Trump in the US presidential election in November. Each state gets a vote, and yesterday a big group of states, including two of the largest, California and Texas, got to have their say. Bernie Sanders, a left-wing senator from Vermont, had pulled into the lead going into Super Tuesday, partly because there were so many centrists in the race. And that was causing panic among the Democratic establishment, who think he's too left-wing to win against Trump. So just before Super Tuesday, two of the centrist candidates, Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, pulled out and threw their weight behind Joe Biden, who was the former vice president to Barack Obama. That helped Biden make the case that he was the only viable alternative to Sanders on the moderate wing going into Super Tuesday.
We are very much alive! And make no mistake about it, this campaign will send Donald Trump packing.
Super Tuesday has cemented an amazing comeback by Biden, who looked like he was out for the count only last week. He's now reclaimed his former status of front runner in the race from Sanders. He won in at least 9 of the 14 states up for grabs, including Texas, and he beat Elizabeth Warren, another left-wing contender, in Massachusetts, her home state.
And when we began this race for the presidency, everybody said it couldn't be done.
But Sanders looks to be way ahead in California, which is the biggest state that voted yesterday. Once all the delegates are divided up, which could take days or even weeks, Sanders could actually end up coming out of Super Tuesday with a very similar number of delegates to Biden. But the key thing is that it's clear now that this is going to be a two-horse race between Sanders and Biden.
So I take away two lessons from that. The first is you don't get what you don't fight for. I am in this fight.
On paper, Elizabeth Warren could have been the ideal candidate to unite the liberal and centrist wings of the Democratic Party. But she only really cut through in her powerful attacks on Bloomberg and during one of the debates. She's been squeezed out by Sanders on the left, and it's hard to escape the conclusion that sexism has also played a role. Her campaign suggested last week that she would keep fighting and hope to be handed the crown at the convention if Sanders fails to win a majority of delegates. But that seems pretty untenable to me, and after coming third in her home state yesterday, this is probably the end of the road for her. Neither Sanders nor Biden is a nailed-on winner right now, and the race goes on. There's another set of primaries next week, which Sanders hopes will give him a boost. But it may be that Sanders and Biden now slug it out state by state, week after week, all the way to the Democratic convention in July. If no candidate has got a majority of delegates by the time of the convention, party bigwigs get to play a role in what is called a contested convention. And most of those bigwigs are terrified of Sanders winning, and they're likely to give the crown to Biden, even if Sanders is ahead at that point. If that happens, Sanders supporters will be absolutely furious, and many might even refuse to vote for Biden in the general election.
The Guardian's Paul Owen there. My thanks to all our guests, Polly Toynbee, Matt Ford, Andrew Jimpson, and Paul Owen. For anyone wanting to hear more about upcoming trade talks between the EU and the UK, my colleague John Henley and a panel of experts will talk through it all in the next episode of Brexit Means, which will be out later in the week. Just search for Brexit Means on the Guardian website or wherever you get your podcasts. But that's all from us this week. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.